It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon. My name is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the show for books and the readers who love them. Today, we're not just talking about one book. We are talking about the book that turns readers into participants, history into memory, and memory into identity, the Haggadah. The Haggadah is, at its heart, a guidebook, a carefully curated anthology of voices, biblical verses, rabbinic interpretation, songs, questions, arguments, poetry, all woven together in a text that invites participation, curiosity, and conversation. Who put this compilation together? How did it evolve over the centuries? What do the different layers of text added over time tell us about Jewish history and identity? And what do the Haggadot of today look and feel like? To unpack these questions and more, we'll be chatting to not one, but two in-studio guests, David Aronovitz and Ilana Stein. But for now, I'd like to know from you. Do you have a Haggadah that gets used every single year, despite all the new ones being published? Ours is the Rabbi Twersky. It's dog-eared, the matzah crumbs from the year before, wine stains. And then, of course, the Rabbi Sacks one. Which ones are yours? Let me know on the SMS line, 061-895-1019. So there are very few books in the world that are not meant to be read alone, quietly from beginning to end, like a book should, but rather spoken out loud, argued over, sung through, spilled on, laughed around, and returned to year after year. The Haggadah is one of them, and it's a book that guides us through the Seder, the ritual meal of Pesach, of Passover, leading us step by step as we tell the story from Exodus. The story of Exodus from Egypt, sorry. More on that later, but first, a word from sponsors.
Turn the page, it's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. My name is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark. We're talking about one of the books of our Jewish tradition and practice, the Haggadah. And what's fascinating about the Haggadah as we know it today is that it was not written in one sitting by one author at one moment in time. It's a layered, evolving text. The word Haggadah comes from the Hebrew V'higadata Levincha, you shall tell your child. And it's a text that directs the Pesach Seder, the order of the evening. But it's not just a guidebook. The Haggadah is part prayer, part storybook, part philosophical text, part manual. It is one of the most widely printed Jewish books in history and one of the most personalized. No two books and no two tellings are ever quite the same. So on today's show, we're going to explore the Haggadah not just as a religious text, but as a living book. There are new voices that enter this conversation all the time. But there are some standout Haggadot worth mentioning, famous even hundreds of years later. Take, for example, the famous Bird's Head Haggadah. I don't know if you've seen it. It was created in the 13th century Germany, and it's well worth a Google search. It's one of the earliest surviving illustrated Haggadot we've got, but with a twist, because instead of the human faces around the Seder table or leaving Egypt, the figures all have birds' heads. Scholars still debate why, perhaps to avoid the graven image problem, perhaps as a symbolic gesture, but the result is both whimsical and deeply mysterious. One thinks of where the wild things are somehow, and it's still, though, a reminder of even the most serious of rituals where there is room for imagination. And then there's the Sarajevo Haggadah, a breathtaking medieval manuscript that traveled across continents and survived wars, expulsions, and even the Holocaust, hidden and protected at great personal risk. It's not just a book, but really a witness to Jewish history. And since then, there are many fun and contemporary Haggadot. I have with me the unofficial Hogwarts Haggadah, but more on that later. There's an Emoji Haggadah. There's a Dr. Seuss Haggadah. And, of course, more serious modern ones. But I think one of the most fascinating stories for me is the story of the Maxwell House Haggadah. It's not entirely familiar to South African audiences, but in America, it's completely ubiquitous. And the story goes like this. It begins with the meeting of two marketing masterminds. The first was Joseph Jacobs, who grew up in the Lower East Side in New York at the turn of the 20th century, amid a wave of Jewish immigration from Eastern Europe. And he then went on to establish his advertising company in 1919. The second person was Joel Olsky Cheek of the Cheek Neal Coffee Company, who hailed from the South. And Cheek Neal was then the parent company of Maxwell House Coffee, with its famous slogan, "Good to the last drop." And during the Great Depression of the 1930s, when a major grocery chain discounted their own brand of coffee, Maxwell House turned to Jacob's firm to help them stay competitive. The Maxwell House Haggadah was born when he suggested distributing the book for free for every purchased can of coffee. And since, over 60 million Maxwell House Haggadahs have been printed, making it the most widely used Haggadah in the world. And I find it amazing. It's a Maxwell House Haggadah promotion. It is the longest running consumer promotion in the US, and it has resulted in Maxwell House being the preferred coffee in Jewish households. I wonder if that's true. So every corner of old and new, every corner of the world, the Haggadah gets reinvented for new and contemporary and fresh Jewish life, for the new generation, using it, making it always relevant, always resonant. To talk more about what's on the shelves and what you can actually find, there's just a taste of some of the Haggadot available. I popped into the Kollel bookstore the other day to see what was new. And as always, I got talking to David Aronovitz, who is an executive life coach by day, but who has, sometimes for fun and sometimes for business, run the Kollel bookstore, which is a Joburg institution since 1981. And I convinced him to move our conversation on air. David, a very warm welcome.
Thank you.
There are hundreds, even thousands of versions of the Haggadah available today. In fact, the National Library of Israel has 15,000 traditional versions from various periods and regions, and I bet you the Hogwarts Haggadah isn't even included in that. And there are many more new Haggadot published every year. What are you seeing on your shelves? How many different Haggadot do you at Kollel stock?
At this moment in time for this year, we've had a choice between the children's section plus the adult section, approximately about 70 different versions, which is outstanding for South Africa. But if you had to go to Jerusalem or to New York, in Lakewood, you must be find a choice of anywhere upwards of between 400 and 500.
Wow.
So the choice is enormous. As you said, there are so many versions of the Haggadah, and according to information that we can try and find out about it, there are approximately 6,000 to 7,000 variations of the Haggadah over the last 200-300 years. We tend to focus on what we feel, and checking out the South African community, what would be most suitable for the community here. So we obviously are buying from various sources in terms of the publishers and looking at the range that will supply the South African community, which is very much more of a broad-based community in terms of traditional Judaism, dominant in the community, and at the same time looking at the more religious community in terms of original Hebrew product, which we have to source from a broad base, again looking at both England, America and Israel, because as you said earlier, the Haggadah has so many different slants, And it's a very subjective view of what was tradition in terms of how one interprets it. I mentioned to you when we met that every one of us is a product of our past. So our interpretation of the concept of freedom is very different. And that's what makes it so exciting in terms of sitting at the actual Seder. So we're seeing a quite an evolution of product over the last 15, 20 years, where today we're producing graphic Haggadot. We're producing more interactive Haggadot. So we're appealing to the person who's looking at something in a far more modern way. It's for South Africa, and I'm being very specific in that area. But we're catering it. We're inviting people to open those pages and to connect to them. There's a Haggadah which has stood out for a long time over the last few years, which was published, which is pure pictures, but extremely graphic. And at the end of the actual Haggadah, you look at the actual index, and it'll bring you all the source material and why it is so graphic in terms of the accuracy of the way it's presented. It's called the Katz Haggadah.
Incredible.
An incredible Haggadah.
Yeah, and I think it reflects also the kind of general trend of graphic novels and the huge explosion we've seen across the publishing world. How to tell a story with images, like almost as a comic strip as well.
Right. Well, there is one. The graphic Haggadah itself is done on comic form, extremely accurate in its translation, but as a comic. And it attracts the younger generation to get involved in it, although an adult can use it too, because the accuracy of the content has to be consistent, whether you're buying a graphic children's Haggadah or you're buying an adult Haggadah. So the content stays the same, it's the presentation that changes.
We're going to hear more later after the break.
Turn the page, it's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
I am in studio with David Aronovitz, who runs the Kollel Bookstore. And of course, it's Haggadah season downstairs. The Kollel Bookstore is just downstairs from the Chai FM studio, so I pop in often. David and I arm wrestle, proverbially, obviously, often over philosophical issues, which we certainly won't do here. But I did want to share with you some of the Haggadot that he showed me a few days ago, just some of the new ones. Fascinating to see what's coming out. David, tell me about some of your new favorites, but then also the classic Haggadot that sell year after year. Why are they classics and why do they sell year after year?
As I mentioned earlier, the Haggadah's content stays the same. It's a matter of presentation. Also, times have changed, so it has to be appropriate in terms of what's happening at that particular moment in Jewish history. We've seen a very, very large focus in the last few years on the concept of bitachon, of belief, of connection to HaKadosh Baruch, to Hashem. And through that, we started seeing that filtering itself into all sorts of books besides the Haggadah. But the Haggadah this year, which has taken the community and the world community by storm, is actually called the Bitachon Haggadah by David Satan. He has written many books in Bitachon specifically towards that subject on its own, but he's put that into a Haggadah with commentary focusing on the relationship between ourselves and Hashem in terms of the actual Exodus. So it becomes a totally new experience in connecting to the concept of freedom. That's been the book of the year for this year to a certain degree. And then there's a book by Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, right, which is a Haggadah coming from a person from a very strong Hasidic background. He's the rabbi of the Eish Kodesh Shul in Five Towns in New York, appealing to a person at the depths of intellectual focus and looking into the Haggadah from a perspective of common modern experience, I would call it that, and giving a very strong, beautiful exposure to the concept of freedom. As I mentioned earlier, freedom's, we're sitting here together and we have a very different approach to freedom based on our own past experience. And that's what makes the Haggadah so broad in terms of its appeal to the community and worldwide, and certainly in terms of the history of it, because everybody writes their, we all could write our own Haggadah. And that's what we're really doing. If I can say, and you mentioned it before, sitting at the Seder table, the whole idea of the mitzvah of the Haggadah is V'Yigadat Levincha. Rabbi Shimon Schwab said one of the failures of his generation, and certainly it still applies now, is that so many parents sit at the table and they listen to the children's V'Yigadat Le'Avicha, to my parents. And that becomes a critical factor in how we actually run the Seder.
Ain't that the truth? I've never thought about that, actually. We're so excited that our children have learned so much that we allow them, well, we invite them to take the stage. But perhaps it needs to be a bit of both.
Well, that's also a very good situation that has occurred in this generation, is that the choice of Haggadahs are there from a young little child all the way through to the most intellectual, deep-seeking adult. So you can find it across the board. But the responsibility and what we try to carry in our range of Haggadahs is that a person, whether it be a parent, a grandparent, anybody sitting at the table, can give their input according to the Haggadah that they have in front of them. We have a tradition that in our family that no two people can come to the Seder with the same Haggadah. And if they don't have a Haggadah, we're prepared to lend them that. I have a personal collection of over 100. And everybody has a different insight in what they bring to the table. And the big thing is to encourage the children to bring it up in the conversation that takes place, not just wait for the Knedlach in the middle of the term.
It's all about the Knedlach, David, didn't you know? David, thank you for spending some time with us. We're going to have to get you upstairs, I think, on a more regular basis. The author Sylvia Beach once said that fitting people with books is as difficult as fitting them with shoes. And I think with Haggadah, it's even more so. Pop into the Kollel. I know that they have sold out of many Haggadot already, but there are gems still to be had. And try and find David or anyone else who can help you and take a look at their range. Do you have a Haggadah that gets used every single year, despite the many new ones on the shelves? I'd love to hear which are yours. Let me know on the SMS line 061-895-1019. Our next guest is a conservationist, a writer, an educator. She writes for African Nature Conservation Entities, and she's the head of education for the Academy of Jewish Thought and Learning, a South African adult education organization where she lectures on Tanakh, Jewish thought, and the vital relationship between Judaism and the environment. Ilana is a Sax scholar. She's a Safaria Word by Word fellow, and she's currently writing a book on the intersection of Judaism and nature. No small feat. She recently ran a course on the evolution and the history of the Haggadah that had me spellbound. And so to unpack the Haggadah, how it came to be, and what makes a good story, what makes a memorable Seder, I am so pleased to welcome Ilana Stein.
Thanks so much, Batya. Good to be here, as always.
Unlike most books with a single author, the Haggadah has evolved over the centuries. So who wrote the Haggadah we have today? Is there one author or editor? And what was the context in which it was written or formed or compiled?
Great, thanks. So the Haggadah's history is fascinating. Let's just begin with, and you've already mentioned, the basic context of the Haggadah is the verse, so there's actually four verses in the Torah that discuss the fact that you should tell your children the story, or the children should ask you about the story of the Exodus. The most famous one is the one that you've mentioned, V'higadat alabincha, and you shall tell your child on that day. But there are actually four, three in the book of Exodus and one in the book of Deuteronomy. And so that gives us one of the basic laws, I guess, about Pesach. In Pesach, you've got to bring a paschal lamb, or at least you used to in the time of the temple. You eat matzah, you have maror, you don't have chametz, unleavened, and you tell a story. So that gives us the base. What happened and how people told the story between being given this law and the end of the Second Temple period, we don't really know. We do know they used to gather in Jerusalem if they could. They would bring a sacrifice of the lamb, and they would then gather in families or groups and they would tell the story of the Exodus. How they told us, this we don't know. But from the destruction of the Second Temple period, we now have a moment in history where the center, the focus of our entire Pesach experience is gone. The temple is gone. We're not allowed in Jerusalem. We're spread across the world. And the sages are beginning to say, how do we keep this? How do we keep the memory? How do we keep our identity? And they begin to bring together verses, ideas, and concepts to start to create what that looks like. What does a story look like when you're so far away now from the source, when you cannot get together the way you used to? That's what they're starting to do. And the first thing they do, which is fascinating, is that they go, well, we always had a fancy family meal. That's what we always did. What's the fanciest banquet that we can see around at our time? It's the Greek banquet, which in fact at the time was known as a symposium. A symposium actually is not like the symposium today, although it has certain elements, but basically it was a fancy schmancy meal where you would get together, you would lie on couches, in other words, you would be leaning to your left, and servants would arrive with appetizers, and a lot of those were dipping. You would dip something into
very
something
fancy.
Else.
Very,
very, very fancy. And so they bring this idea now together and start to say, what do we say now at this meal?
That's great, and that makes sense. But the premise of the Seder and the Haggadah is that we tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. But then we don't really tell the story. We don't do a great job in the Seder of actually telling the story. What's that about?
Right. Well, I guess it all depends on how you tell a story. So that's the next part. So now we've got the context. The sages now are going, what do we need in that makes this, that firstly keeps the essential bits of the story? So the essential bits, firstly, are the things we eat. But we're not going to just eat them. We're going to talk about them. So that's the famous line towards the end of the Haggadah, Rabban Gamliel, who says, whoever does not say these three things does not fulfill the mitzvah, the commandment of the Seder night. So that's going to be your Pesach Matzah Maror, and then we tell that. But there are other ways to tell a story, and the sages arrive at a number of different things. The first is that there always have to be questions and answers. Or actually, there always have to be questions. Whether there's answers is another story. And the Talmud, in fact, discusses the fact that questions are so important that you hope the children will ask them. But if there are no children, anyone else can ask a question. And in fact, if a person is sitting on their own for a Seder, they have to ask themselves questions. That's how important questions are, firstly, when you tell a story. You start with questions. And so what you'll see, and it's not just the four questions, but dotted throughout the Seder, you will see questions throughout the Haggadah. That would be your one thing. The second thing, of course, is a narrative arc. And there are narrative arcs throughout the Seder, meaning you're going to start with once upon a time and you're going to end with happily ever after. Or in the words of the Talmud, Matchil bignut misayem b'shevach, you will begin with shame and you will end with praise. But what I want to say is that within the Seder, hidden within the Seder, there are in fact at least four different ways to tell a story. So it's not one story that's told in one narrative arc, but multiple levels, multiple ways to tell the story, because you're going to have, as David was speaking about, multiple audiences. So within the Seder, there's something for everyone. There's a way of the story to evolve that will hit the soul, hit the kishkas of every person who is sitting there.
Give us an example.
So, for example, you could say that the one way of saying the story is, and this is the argument in the Talmud, is the story of beginning in shame and ending in praise one of basic physical redemption? We were slaves. God took us out. Let's eat, right? That's the famous line that we always say. So that's there. And that you will find there. And that's where we lift the matzah and we say, this is the bread of affliction. And then God took us out. Easy peasy. But the next layer is a spiritual slavery and redemption. And that's going to be a story that tells us that in the beginning, our forefathers were idolaters. And then they came to create a relationship with God who takes them out and seals that relationship at Mount Sinai. That's the next layer of story.
So we're looking at layers of story, really an experiential guide to living a story rather than just telling a story beginning, middle, and end.
Correct.
And so it makes sense that the questioning device is used as a literary device, actually. Tell me more about the Ma'anesh Tanah, a little bit of history, because it is so fascinating, but also something that I had never considered, that the Ma'anesh Tanah is really just the beginning of the questions that you should be asking at your Seder, or that should prompt you to ask more questions at your Seder.
Absolutely. Well, you've hit the nail on the head, because if we look at the original discussion in the Talmud, in Psachim, it's called, in chapter 10 of the Mishnah, we'll see that that in fact, the way that the Talmud describes it is it says, this is how we begin. You're going to pour your cup, you're going to have Kiddush, and then you're going to start the story, and the child should ask. But the Mishnah then continues and says, if the child doesn't know how to ask or can't ask, Aviv Melamdo, his parent, today's parent, mother, father, should prompt. And the prompt is actually our Ma'anesh Tanah, which we have our children singing, in fact, were the prompts that the parent would give to the child to say, here, you can ask anything you want. I'm just going to tell you a couple of questions to get you started. We want the child to ask a question in a spirit of curiosity, not because that's what they sing, which is, of course, wonderful. And, of course, all of us have our favorite memories of that. That's okay. But that's just the beginning, because what we want is for that child to think of a question that is not part of the Seder. Because that spirit of curiosity, as Rabbi Sacks says, the Judaism believes that questions is the beginning of religion. It is not just acceptance. It is not just quiet sitting and listening. On the contrary, we question and we push so that we grow. It's the only way that you grow. So what's interesting about the Ma'anesh Tanah, stop me if you've heard this, is that in fact the original three, with the original four questions in the Mishnah are in fact three, and they're not the ones that we have. The only ones that we have was the one on the matzah and the one on dipping, but they did not have at the time of the Mishnah the maror question. That got added later. And they also didn't have the question of the leaning. They had a question about why we have roast lamb, really, and this night, because at the time of the Mishnah, they were still allowed to eat something that reminded them of the Paschal lamb, but that became eventually something that they didn't do. So that question falls off because that's no longer relevant. And the question of leaning comes on. Why? Because leaning, which was something that was so natural at the time of the symposia, of the banquets, was not going to be a question that you'd ask because it was obvious that you were going to be leaning. But by the time of the Gemara, later in about the 9th century, 7th, 8th, 9th century, people are sitting in chairs. They're not leaning. So that now, if you lean, that becomes a question to ask. Why are we leaning?
It just shows that kind of layer of history, of Jewish history, as we live through it. They added that when it was relevant and it made sense to that generation. And it was about making the story your own, which that principle remains. And that's what
Absolutely.
All these, you know, Haggadot from the Hogwarts Haggadah to the Jedi Haggadah to the Dr. Seuss one, but then also, of course, the more serious ones and ones with real commentary but totally different flavors. It was all about making it relevant for yourself and for your generation so that you yourself felt like you came out of Egypt, which is the whole point.
Absolutely. The point is for you to feel. You have to feel, and that's what you were saying. It's an experiential moment, even though there are lots of words. Some of those words should make you feel and bring you to this point of questioning.
You need your microphone.
What Lana's saying is so relevant because you've used the word living. But we add another thing in the Haggadah when we say Bechol Dor Vador, in every generation, which is implying ourselves year in, year out, throughout our lives, we are re-experiencing that as a living, and that's the involvement, a living involvement in the discussion and the story. And that's why we see so many new variations coming out every single year, and they'll continue at Beer's Goel.
More after the break.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
This is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark. There are thousands of different Haggadot on the shelves, illustrated, political, humorous, modern, traditional, and each offers its own take on the core Haggadah text. But there is a core. Ilana, can you tell us about the bones of the Seder, as it were?
All right. So because, as I said to you, there's this is about telling a story, but then the story gets built over about 1,000 years. And during that 1,000 years, what the sages are doing are discussing what best fits in and what doesn't. And what we know now from the findings of the Cairo Geniza, for example, is that there were multiple versions, not like today where you have one core and then just different ways of presenting it, etc., but literally different Haggadot, until eventually around the 12th century or thereabouts, it gets consolidated into the one that we have today. So what do you need in your core Haggadah? Well, we first need your basic mitzvot, your basic commands need to be there. Obviously, as we said, the Pesach offering just gets spoken about. You need to have your matzah maror. You need to then tell the story, and that's where things get a little more complex. Once the rabbis, of course, then place other things in, for example, the 4 cups of wine, so you need those. You then need a little bit of dipping. You need, charoset is not an absolute, although it's already mentioned at the time of the Mishnah, because that's going to be your sweet thing, into which you dip your bitter thing. So all these things are perhaps, you could say, core. But actually, from the point of view of the story, according to the sages, you need your questions and answers. You need your questioning. You need your narrative arc, in whichever way you'd like, and then you need the gratitude to God for taking us out of Egypt. And that's an important point, because, and what you've asked before is, where's the story? It's interesting, because we would ask the classic question, which is, why don't we use the verses from Exodus? There's your story, and it's a thrill a minute. Why aren't we using those verses? Why do we use 4 verses from the book of Deuteronomy, the context of which is when the Jewish farmer in the land of Israel would take his first fruits, his or her first fruits, to the temple? These are the verses they would say, giving thanks to God for taking us out of Egypt and bringing us to the land of Israel in order to bring our fruits to the temple. So that's actually the context that we're given. Those are the verses that we are given. That's the magid, that's the long bit, which a lot of people struggle with. That, I might tell you, is another layer of story, though, because that's your intellectual story. We've had your basic slave story. We've had your spiritual story. This is your intellectual unpacking of those verses. That's what's going on there. But, of course, you can go wherever you want with that. But the reason for that story, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, is because that story is all about giving thanks. And that, the Haggadah or the Seder without thanks, is just another story.
Hmm. Yeah, that's. I think that's a very deep Jewish message and living value, you know, that there isn't just a happily ever after. There's no such thing. It's about what happens. What is the meaning after the so-called happy ending, or happy pause, should we say?
Absolutely.
Sometimes the Seder is a blur, let's be honest. You mentioned the Magid section. But there are unforgettable bits that punctuate the Seder and almost mark your progress through those 14, 15 stages. The Manishtana, the Four Sons, the Ten Plagues, Dayenu, and it must be said, the Knedlach. In our Absolutely. House, a big highlight of the Seder is communal, slightly wacky renditions of Chagadya and Who Knows One. I actually hate it, but the family absolutely love it. This is the highlight of the evening. It usually involves outlandish dress-up and props. It's a lot of fun, but actually it's not part of the core Seder. What do these additions tell us about the Seder and about the Haggadah? And can you give us a bit of background to these additions that really have become, well, they feel kind of part of the Seder?
Absolutely. Well, firstly, to say that your Seder officially actually ends with your last cup of wine, which is said on the last bit of what's called Hallel HaGadol. It's the last bit. It's a psalm from the Book of Psalms that we sing, and then we say we have our last, you know, which is really delicious by that stage, a cup of wine, and we bench on it. And that's really the end. There's a little sort of verse, Chasal Sidur Pesach, which in my family we sing to the tune of the Chanukah tune for some reason. But anyway, and that's really the end of the Seder. But then there are these songs, as you say, that get added. And they get added from about the 13th century onwards. So as I said, that's sort of consolidated at that point. And now things like Chad Gadya, Echad Meyodeh are all being mentioned. They get added at the possibly darkest time of Jewish history until the Holocaust, which is the Crusades. Post-Crusades, it's just before the Inquisition, actually, but it's the expulsions from multiple places in Europe. And it seems that people needed more. They needed to bring in songs that affirmed their belief that there would be redemption, that there was light at the end of the tunnel, because we would be celebrating a past redemption. But where we are now, you know, is not light, or at least it wasn't then. And for us, I think we've had an inkling of that, certainly over the last couple of years, of what that looks like. And so people felt then the need to add it. Now, here's the point, is that we said the Haggadah gets consolidated into a certain core, but it's always, and you said it before, it's not history, it's memory. Rabbi Sacks always talks about the difference between history and memory, because history tells you that story, but memory is something you live. And as David said, you know, that in each generation we should see ourselves. How can you see yourself in that situation? It is if it's a memory. If it's history, then you're an intellectual student of history. That's different. But we feel we can add and we must add to the Haggadah in different ways every year, because we almost concertina our past into our present. That's what gives you at the end of it that feeling of gratitude, that feeling of faith. That only comes, though, once you've put the two together.
It's such a different way of understanding books and writing and so-called literature. It's a whole different way of understanding it. Ilana, thank you for sharing some of your wisdom with us. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And of course, when there is a book about Judaism and the environment that is published, we expect to have you back. So thank you very much. Today, we promised to chat about the Haggadah, but I want to end with a book that I think will change my understanding of both the slavery we suffered in Egypt, the awesomeness of the redemption that came afterwards, and the Pesach experience in general. I want to tell you a little bit more about The Last Slave by Y. Kormonek, and we're going to talk about it after the break.
Turn the page, it's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. This is Batya Bricker, and you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM's Bookmark, the show for books and the people who love them. My last feature is a book called The Last Slave by Y. Kormonek. And you may wonder, if we're running a show on the Haggadah, why I have included it. But this is a book that has completely transformed my sense of Pesach and the Exodus, the story of the Exodus from Egypt. The Last Slave is historical fiction, and it brings to life our Egyptian origins in a way that no academic work can do. It uses actual Torah sources, midrashim, and words from the sages to weave the narrative of the Exodus, and it makes it come alive in dramatic and frankly unputdownable ways. He creates a narrative that is intimate rather than grand. So he chooses to tell the story of individual lives, of individual choices, of the moral complexities, rather than the sweeping historical story, which is, of course, the background. And this is how it feels. I'm reading the back of the book. In the land of Egypt, the Hebrews are multiplying at an alarming rate. Hate is mounting, fear is rising, and Pharaoh is determined to destroy them. The Hebrews are bound in shackles. Their babies are thrown into the Nile. But inside the palace walls, there are secrets, for not everyone is bent on their destruction. Tyr, and of course this is fictional, an Egyptian aristocrat, loyal maidservant to the princess Batya, is a traitor to the throne. And she is not the only one. But secrets cannot be kept forever, and in a world filled with lies and hate, treachery comes at a terrifying cost. So the result of the story of Tyr and everyone else around her is that it feels personal and immediate, and you feel like you're not just reading history, but you're feeling it moment by moment through characters who are forced to navigate power, survival, dignity, and identity. So for example, we all know the heartwarming story of Pharaoh's daughter, the princess of Egypt, Batya, who rescues Moses from the bulrushes. We've all coloured in that drawing with the bulrushes and the baby and the cute basket. And I've never given much thought to the sheer complexity of this small detail, actually, in the big Exodus story. What possessed Batya to take the risk in saving one Jewish boy when hundreds were being drowned by her father's ordinances? Why what she did to save this baby boy would not just disappoint her father, which, if we're honest and on a human level, that's hard for all of us to do, but it was basically treason. So why did she do it? Why did she take such immense risk? She would have had handmaids loyal to the Pharaoh and his decrees surrounding her at all times. How did she actually pull this off in plain sight, without them getting in the way? And there must have been fierce gossip and accusations whispered in the royal court thereafter, and for the years in which she then had Moses in her court. How did she get away with it? And she must have wrestled with her conscience. Why save this boy, this drop in the ocean, really, and put her life and reputation in such peril? So you can hear, it really prompted me to think very differently about the characters of the Exodus story and what they might have gone through on a very personal level, deep, profound challenges and moral dilemmas. This book gives you a glimpse into the humanity and the moral complexity of the stories and the characters we think we know, but actually in many ways our understanding sometimes remains childish and superficial in that nursery school room. Now, there is a warning. This book is not for sensitive readers. I found it really hard to read in parts because the slavery in Egypt was truly horrific. I don't think I've ever internalized how bad, and the descriptions hold no bars. It's almost like Holocaust literature. But if each one of us is meant to feel that we ourselves left Egypt, then taste the starvation, to feel the blows, to wince at the cruelty. I did have to take breaks in some of the difficult moments. And then the redemption is on the way. And you feel their hope, their anticipation, the deep fear that maybe it will come to naught. And this was something that I also didn't internalize. That long wait between visits of Moses and Aaron to Pharaoh, waiting to see if these rumors of plagues, of blood, of all the things that were promised actually come to pass, and they didn't actually know. So you really do sit at the edge of your seat. And I think for those of us, I mean, we're living through this, where you're waiting for big news the whole time. Can you imagine what that must have felt like? I think this book will hugely impact your experience of Pesach. It certainly will mine. And for that, I can certainly recommend it. I hope you have enjoyed this deep dive into the Haggadah, a Jewish book for reliving and embodying history or memory, as we discovered. Wherever you are in the world, by choice or by fate, I wish you a Chag Kasher V'Sameach, a kosher and joyous Pesach. I hope you have a big stack of books, tottering pile next to your bed for in between the eating and the shul and the socializing. So happy reading.